today on Against the Grain. What is this thing called financialization, and what has it done to university campuses and students? I'm C.S. Aris Komporosos Athanasiou has co-written an article called An Anxiety Epidemic in the Financialized University. You'll hear from him coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. College students want to learn, and they want to eventually support themselves. They want to make a good living. But what happens when good jobs, stable jobs, are hard to find? What happens to a student's emotional and mental health when full-time employment with good pay and benefits appears elusive? When the student's future is unpredictable, in fact, radically unpredictable. Many explanations have been offered for what's been characterized as an anxiety epidemic among college students, but Aris Komporosos Athanasiou believes a crucial element, an ignored causal factor, is financialization, is the way the financial sector and its logic has influenced and transformed our social, political, and individual lives. Aris Komporosos Athanasiou is Associate Professor of Sociology at University College London and the author of Speculative Communities, Living with Uncertainty in a Financialized World. He co-authored with Max Haven an article called A, quote, anxiety epidemic, unquote, in the financialized university, critical questions and unexpected resistance, which recently appeared in the journal Cultural Politics. That article focuses on public universities in the US, the UK, and Canada. When Aris and I connected recently, I asked what he meant by financialization.
So by financialization, we mean a set of interrelated phenomena that operate on various levels. So first of all, we refer to the increasing prevalence and power of finance in economic terms, in the sense of the explosive growth of financial institutions, financial markets. This is a very well understood phenomenon that has led to various crises, perhaps most recently the 2008 global debt crisis that became a broader economic crisis. So this kind of aggressive growth of finance that we can observe at the level of the economy. But then there is also another few very interesting ways in which finance establishes and legitimates its dominance, and that is at the level of politics. So this is where we can see a financial logic, a marketized logic. We can call this neoliberal, we can call it free market economics. This is the kind of the prevalence of those ideas related with the expansion of financial markets and the loosening of the regulation of those markets by elite political institutions. So this kind of closer entanglement of politics and finance that, again, we observe the world over. But then there is another level, the level of the social and the cultural, where finance increasingly penetrates and it increasingly makes itself part of the fabric of our everyday social and cultural life. And this is a fascinating area of study where both Max and myself have been involved in for a number of years. And so by that I mean not only finance in the sense of its influence on the economy and politics, but also in the ways in which everyday people, ordinary people, come to imagine themselves, their relationships to others, their own futures, and they come to act as subjects in a financialized world. And so we see that this is a process whereby finances own not just logic, as I mentioned earlier, but finances own imagination, the way in which markets respond to uncertain futures by way of capitalizing on that uncertainty and volatility, leveraging an uncertain future for profit in the present. That is a way of imagining that increasingly we see sort of spilling over to the realm of society and culture. And so individuals acquiring or inhabiting that role, that identity of the speculator, the speculative subject that is confronted with an array of different choices about risk and opportunity, but not only that kind of entrepreneurial logic of risk and opportunity costs, but also of having to take decisions about education, about family life, about housing, but also about consuming culture and art, decisions that happen in a way that is highly speculative. So I think those three levels are interconnected, and they are what make financialization such a prevalent and formidable and dangerous phenomenon of the last several decades.
You write that financialization is driven by the FIRE sector. FIRE standing for what?
FIRE standing for finance, insurance, and real estate.
And the finance part of that stands for things like lending and borrowing and betting on the future?
Yeah, precisely. So by finance, we mean from the operation of big institutions, banking institutions, investment banks, hedge funds, private equity funds, to the big global exchanges, to unregulated exchanges like crypto markets and so on, and the ecosystems, the regulatory ecosystems that are operate around those institutions.
What's happened to the power, or I should say the share of the financial sector in relation to the economy as a whole? How big has it become? And talk more about the power and influence of the FIRE sector over institutions, over private and public institutions.
So what has happened in the period that interests myself and Max in this article, so from the 1970s roughly to today, is a huge growth of financial markets, and the deregulation of financial markets have led to a huge growth of forms of speculation, forms of risk management that have transformed the world of markets. So for example, the percentage of trading that takes place with products, very highly risky products like derivative products, futures, and very complicated, complex financial instruments has skyrocketed. I don't have the exact numbers on hand, but there is more trading taking place with derivative products, greater value, overall value in dollars in those more riskier markets than in standard sort of stock trading products. So that's, again, one level where in economic terms we can observe financialization and the dominance of finance. But then, of course, at the same time, we have the implicit logic of finance, and that is it's the way it weaponizes debt and risk as instruments for profit making, that we see a great proliferation of those instruments in the broader economic system with catastrophic consequences. So, you know, what I was talking about, the dominance of a financial instrument like the derivative, was a key development behind the debt crisis of the 2007-08 crisis. And that had a social dimension in that it relied on mass indebtedness and in the mortgage market, and it imposed that model of this skewed relation between debt and credit upon large swathes of society, with the consequences that we all know. So, and the same logic of risk debt is observed in various other economic sectors, and not only economic sectors, but also spaces that were previously not treated in economic terms. So the universities, that brings us to the universities, which is, of course, a highly marketized, highly financialized space, sector of society that has been financialized in a way that is very interesting to us, but also it's a model of the rise of finance.
So this indebtment, this indebtedness, you know, a lot of people might not associate that with public universities, right? Universities, institutions funded with public dollars, with government dollars. And yet you and Max make the case or point out the fact that there is a lot of indebtedness, that debt plays a large role in the operation of public institutions, public universities, given their ambitions with regard to new building and other kinds of capital costs.
Yeah, so again, this logic of debt and indebtedness, it operates on a number of levels. So there is, in the university systems that we are looking at, in mostly in the UK, Canadian and US contexts, although I should say these contexts have very important differences as well. But, you know, we can speak of the private university, the private institution that directly, you know, there are financial terms are involved in more explicit terms, and so debt is more perhaps easily recognizable along financial terms. But as you said, then there are public institutions, or let's say the UK case, for instance, where institutions occupy that in-between space between private and public. I mean, but they do rely on public funding and increasingly on student income, but there is, it's a more regulated market. So debt there to manifest itself, and indebtedness manifests itself on the financial level, in the sense of, you know, in the UK market, for instance, students receive loans that they have to repay upon graduation and receiving a certain level of income. But there is also, again, much like finance and financialization that has this profound social and cultural aspect, debt itself expresses something that is social and cultural, in that it is an expression of the relationship of a subject to its future. And there is something that happens in universities, regardless of the financial level of indebtedness, that allows us to see the operation of that logic of debt. So the level of decisions taken by the student with regards to the choices they have to make, the choices of subject to study, the choices of field, of knowledge, of type of knowledge that is deemed investable for a future, for allowing them to navigate an uncertain future. There is there in that relationship, we argue in this article, an increasing anxiety that appears. So there is a sense of a future that, even where it's not, there isn't a financial sum to be repaid in the future, there is always a very contradictory entanglement between present and future that is mediated by the university in this very relentless environment of anxiety and uncertainty that universities increasingly host and cultivate.
That's Aris Komporosos Athanasiou. He is Associate Professor of Sociology at University College London. And we are talking about an article he co-authored with Max Haven. It's called A, quote, Anxiety Epidemic, close quote, in the Financialized University, Critical Questions and Unexpected Resistance. It was published in the journal Cultural Politics. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the pressures that you're speaking of, that students are experiencing, maybe even students who are not indebted in the sense of taking out, you know, massive loans, of course, although that can be a tremendous source of pressure as well. You are saying that it causes anxiety. And, well, let's start here, because the title of your article, Euromax's article, is a quote, anxiety epidemic. So what has been noted or reported or documented about what might be called, or I guess what is called in some quarters, an actual epidemic of anxiety?
Yeah, this is a good question. I mean, this is, it gives me the opportunity to talk a little bit about what started us off in this journey. This wasn't really a project which had a theoretical motivation, at least initially. It was a concern that Max and I both had that came from our day-to-day life within our own respective institutions. So I teach at University College London. Max is faculty at Lakehead University in Canada. And I'm talking here about an experience that the two of us shared. Year after year after year, we have been confronted by rapidly increasing levels of reported student anxiety. Our students, that is, self-reporting anxiety, our university administrative systems increasingly developing mechanisms and tools to deal with that, with mental health issues. So a mental health language and mental health infrastructures becoming part and parcel of the university experience. But also, this is an experience that Max and I very often we would discuss with our colleagues, an experience that with quite serious, very concerning, alarming aspects with regards to our own roles as educators, whereby we would be frequently, for example, called to intervene in situations with students under our tutorial and pastoral care, students dealing with serious mental health challenges in ways that we felt, to start with, not equipped to be dealing with, to be providing that kind of support, but then also experiencing a transformation of our institutions, the universities, whereby resources were pulled towards forms of mental health support that, for example, offered our students opportunities to have contact time with mental health professionals, but also making allowances and giving them time and space to deal with mental health issues and rebalance their academic commitments. So a whole ecosystem of the university that we live in, that we dwell in, that has been preoccupied and anxious itself about that issue of this mental health epidemic. And starting from that topic, we were always, Max and I have been, we also shared a frustration with the ways in which this so-called epidemic of anxiety in universities is explained or explained away in ways that are very superficial perhaps, and that do not seem to really understand the depth of the problem, or indeed the link between that kind of mental health epidemic and systemic, structural forms of inequality, pressures to do with the growth of financialization in the institutions that we inhabit.
So you were witnessing certain things in your roles in the university as faculty and as people who cared about their students' welfare and what they were going through on the psychological level, on the emotional level. Was your observations about what you were seeing and what you were learning anecdotally supported by broader findings relating to this notion or this observation that more and more students were suffering from anxiety and from other sorts of related mental health conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. The rise of the discourse around the epidemic had a very sort of material explanation, which was the reporting of mental health problems amongst university populations in the countries of our focus, at least, skyrocketed over the last decade or so. I mean, the increase in the resources that were driven towards mental health support services in universities was definitely documented in the countries of our focus, but also, and this was part of our research, we looked at the media coverage of this mental health crisis in universities, and we could see again in this period from the late 2000s to early 2010s to the time of this publication that the reports of serious incidents, for instance, students taking their own lives, very high publicity incidents in some of the elite institutions within those countries that attracted a lot of attention. There seemed to be a chain of those events during this more recent period.
So all this brings up the question of what is causing the anxiety, the widespread anxiety among students. And you've talked to some degree about that. I would like you to, since you and Max focus on this in your piece, talk about the dimension of financialization and financialized logic creeping into everyday life, including the life of the students, including the life of universities, including public ones. The role of financialization in the growth of student anxiety in your mind. In fact, you write that the epidemic in student anxiety is roughly coterminous with financialization in general and its impacts on the university since the 1990s, which is quite striking and does suggest a causal link. So what is it about financialization and what it's doing to people on an imaginative level and other levels that you think is fueling this rise in student anxiety?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is where our approach towards understanding finance is very important. In these multiple layers on which finance operates, on which we can observe finance's influence in our lives, especially in this more recent turn of financialization. And by that more recent turn, I'm referring to here the growth of the particularly high-risk types of finance and their involvement in developments in our economic and political life. See, for instance, the debt crisis of 2008. So the way in which we could best describe the specific influence of financialization on anxiety within universities would be by focusing on what financialization did in shifting and reshaping the relationship between students' relationship between present and future. And so, and in particular, the ways in which students are being forced to manage their present in the university and through the university whilst attempting to secure themselves or to survive a highly, an increasingly more radically uncertain future. And so there are elements of finance that are particularly geared towards the management of that relationship.
What are those elements of finance to which you refer?
So the asset logic, for instance, the way in which financialized capitalism places this great emphasis on asset value. This is a logic that has crept into the financialized university, which is seen as an agent consisting of assets to be speculated on, to be leveraged on, including here both material, real estate assets that university institutions are entering these markets very aggressively now in order to leverage income, but also the student population, as well as the teaching staff, whose asset value becomes part and parcel of the financialized university. And so there is something about the subject of the student who finds themselves in that financialized asset-oriented environment that triggers a very specific relationship with their future. So if the student emerges in this financialization process as a speculative subject, as a subject whose education, whose experience at the university is a route to an investment and speculation on assets. Assets, I should say, that have no visible return, that they're increasingly, and this is a very important development here that interested Max and I in this environment, that the return on investment, to use a slightly older term of the financialized university, there used to be a time of the neoliberal university that there was a visible future, a visible return on the investment made in the present on behalf of the student that offered some veneer of justification for the economization, the entrepreneurial nature shifts within the university, that there was a hope, in other words, to put it simply, that the future, that this will pay off, that there is, there will be indeed an opportunity lying further down the line upon graduation and so on. And so, but this is something that increasingly, and especially after the 2008 financial crisis, this horizon of the future got more and more, it narrowed more and more. And so students find themselves in a position where they have to speculate, they have to treat their education as an asset with some returns on the future, but where at the same time that very future becomes unmanageable, becomes entirely unpredictable in ways that profoundly destabilize and push students towards this feeling of loss of that future. So the combination of the unmanageability of the future and the imperative to continue speculating, continue treating one's education as an asset, it is that juncture that leads, in our view, the current student population in the Anglo-American university to be faced with this particular form of anxiety, which was the focus of our study.
Aris Komporosos Athanasiou is his name. He's a sociologist based at University College London's Social Research Institute. We'll take a short music break and then talk more with Aris about anxiety in the context of the financialized university. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Aris Komporosos Athanasiou is Associate Professor of Sociology at University College London. We are talking about an article he co-authored with Max Haven titled An Anxiety Epidemic in the Financialized University, Critical Questions and Unexpected Resistance. Aris, I'd like you to talk a bit more about what you mean by speculation. Because I certainly understand the argument that, well, I think it's important what you and Max argue about the fact that decades ago, when jobs were easier to get, then students could, invest. They could put their talents and efforts while at the university into getting degrees. that they would consider to be valuable assets that then could translate into job offers and perhaps full-time jobs with good pay and benefits. But I think you are pointing to something that many of us know, which is that it's much more difficult these days to get the job, to get a good-paying job, a secure job with benefits. And that can throw all of the students' hopes and aspirations, their expectations for the future, into chaos or into very uncertain terrain. So is that what you mean when you say speculate, that they can only speculate about what they might be able to achieve or obtain in the future? And that sort of speculative attitude, that having to fall back on speculation as opposed to reasonable expectation, is a factor in the rise of anxiety, of suicide, of other mental health issues?
To some extent, yes. The shift that you described just there, from a period of, I don't want to say relative stability, because uncertainty has always been experienced in profoundly skewed ways by those communities that had, you know, that were most excluded from the system itself. But certainly the generalization of this radical uncertainty in the sense of, say, job insecurity and or housing insecurity, you know, these developments certainly led to a qualitative change in the experience and in the responses to that uncertainty that we can observe in various realms. And I think the university is one such realm. But that's one of the things that we claim. The other important factor here is that because of that more generalized and radicalized role of uncertainty, the students, the call to speculate also yields very little hope. It's a unique juncture there whereby, like I said earlier, the imperative to speculate in order to survive is combined with an increased realization as well, and perhaps cynicism about the very possibility and the chances of any real returns in that future. And I want to maybe unpack this a little bit more, because it also relates to the relative optimism that our article conveys.
Optimism is an interesting word for you to bring up in this context. What's the basis for your and Max's optimism, given the distressing situation you've been describing?
These are based on the fact that we wanted to ask the question here, if this is the case, if students do find themselves increasingly in that juncture whereby they are financialized, they are more and more consciously inhabiting those institutions where these financial terms are taking over their day-to-day lives, then could this kind of anxiety, which is usually analyzed on individual terms, usually pathologized, usually seen as something to be perhaps dismissed as a phenomenon to do with new technologies of distraction and lack of focus of attention to the real matters. Maybe if we shift away from those explanations, and could we see a different kind of potential in the more collective realization amongst the student body of their anxious position vis-a-vis those financialized structures that they inhabit? And this is what, for Max and I, this was a crucially important question to ask.
This question, this inquiry, has, I think, something to do with the original research plan that you and Max Haven devised and intended, at least initially, to carry out. What was that plan?
The research that led to this article that we're discussing today was supposed to take place in a participatory manner with including running of workshops with students to explore precisely that collective and social dimension of this anxiety epidemic. In the end, because of COVID, we weren't able to do that, but we did nonetheless work very closely with one student researcher in our team, Anna Reed, and with her we looked at a great wealth of examples of forums whereby students congregated and discussed their experiences of anxiety and mental health. And in those examples, we found many instances whereby students invoked structural causes of their mental health problems, but where also we saw the display of a certain solidarity, of a certain sense of belonging to a collectivity that are experiencing this kind of anxiety beyond their own individual rooms, beyond this kind of image, if you like, of that doom scroller locked away in their rooms, distracted from their studies and consumed by their screens. So we saw elements in that work of students making recourse to narratives of anxiety to understand and renegotiate their participation in this financialized institution they inhabit. Now, these are perhaps seeds of something that might be developing, but again, they relate to perhaps a broader reading that Max and I have of financialization itself, that some of its contradictory elements also are on some occasions opening up opportunities for a kind of politics that might not look what we expected to look in the sense of traditional kind of forms of resistance, but it might nonetheless contain interesting and important possibilities for resistance that looks differently. In our case, with the students, for example, using the mental health support system in ways that could be subversive, or by kind of displaying a kind of a cynicism around the role of those mental health support systems within the broader asset management, speculating, financialized university. So the forms of resistance that might look perhaps like a withdrawal from that financialized system, or indeed a mass refusal. So these were elements that we touched on in this project, and these are mostly left as fascinating questions that we think much more work is needed to understand in this kind of politics, this political dimension of anxiety in the university.
His name is Aris Komporosos Athanasiou. We have a spelling of his name on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches sociology at University College London's Social Research Institute, where he is an associate professor. He's an editor of the British Journal of Sociology, and he co-authored with Max Haven an article called An Anxiety Epidemic, that's in quotes, in the Financialized University, Critical Questions and Unexpected Resistance. So, Aris, you referred earlier to three sort of, or several mainstream explanations of the epidemic, of this anxiety epidemic among students. And I'm going to actually just read them from your paper and then have you respond to, you know, with your reaction. The first explanation that is popularized is the notion that today's students are a coddled generation, victims of permissive and overly indulgent parenting and pedagogy that has left them not only ill-equipped to contend with the rigors of academic life, but also dangerously hostile to diverse viewpoints. The second explanation for this increasing reporting of anxiety among students is that the epidemic is best explained by the harmful impacts on youth of ubiquitous handheld computing devices and social media over the last dozen years or so. And the third explanation that has wide circulation is that mental distress is a medical matter that should be treated on an individual basis through either behavioral modification, psychiatric therapy, or pharmaceutical correction. So a lot to ask you about here, but how would you evaluate or assess these explanations? In what ways might they have merit, and in what ways do they miss an important facet of the problem?
Yeah, so in our view, all three of those explanations contain some grains of truth. There are elements of those that capture a dimension of the student anxiety as a phenomenon. So yes, there is something about the shift of politics, university politics, its manifestations in terms, in identity terms, that signal a departure on many occasions of more traditional kind of structural forms of political activism, or indeed the types of student unionization that we're more familiar with in previous decades. Then there is something in the explanation of the technological impact, the explanations that tend to focus on the impact of screen life taking over real life, and the distractions of new technologies, social media, and so on, that simply make the students less capable of focusing on the longer investments of in education and knowledge. Indeed, you know, this proliferation of these technologies is undeniable, and they do something in the way the students relate to time, temporality, and the capacity to use their attention. And then finally, there is the notion that mental distress is a medical matter, and it ought to be treated on a basis of psychiatric treatment, therapy, pharmaceutical correction. Again, of course, in our article, we're not suggesting that there is no medical dimension in this anxiety, what we call the anxiety epidemic. Indeed, the role of medical intervention can be very important in addressing mental health challenges. However, each of those explanations, we argue, neglects, more or less intentionally, the sociological and political economic factors that lead to the student anxiety epidemic, and all of which are expressed in the phenomenon of financialization of the university. So yes, there's traditional forms of student unionization and new expressions of politics are taking place, but these also contain forms of collective expression of community care, solidarity, parts of which also recognize and work with anxiety. Yes, technologies have proliferated, but students, we find, often use and turn to those technologies not only as instruments of pleasure or distraction, but also as nodes of connection, and indeed as solidarity and mutual support. And then the medicalization of the matter of anxiety is insufficient in explaining precisely those structural, social, collective, relational elements that are so important in the experiences of student anxiety. So we wanted to go beyond and recognize and identify the weaknesses of these explanations. And we felt that the lens that financialization offers to us to understand this epidemic on structural terms is very important. And as we just discussed, precisely through some of the contradictory elements that we observe in the unfolding of financialization, to do with indebtedness, to do with speculation, the position, this new kind of subject that these elements nurse, they cultivate, and finally, to see in those elements, to see in those developments, not simply a wholly negative phenomenon, but also, like I said earlier, maybe the seeds of opportunities of a different form of collective consciousness, of collective imagination at play in the politics of anxiety at university.
Aris Komporosos Athanasio joins me. He teaches sociology at University College London. And as I mentioned earlier, your book, Speculative Communities, Living with Uncertainty in a Financialized World, was published earlier this year. What is that book about?
So the book is very much about some of these themes that we've been discussing today, especially the theme of uncertainty. Uncertainty as a feature of our financialized world, but also as a trigger of a specific way in which societies And political collectivities seem to be responding to these challenges posed by a radical uncertainty. So in the book, I make a provocative argument for drawing on finance, drawing on the doings, the complex doings of the financial markets, the way in which financial markets, as we were just discussing, cultivate and capitalize on uncertainty for profit, to look at those processes not merely as stifling our social and political imagination, but also as influencing our own imagination, as leading us to imagine and on some occasions inadvertently imagine in radical ways our forms of resistance to financialized capitalism. And what I mean by that, this has a lot to do with the notion of speculation that we have been discussing, a notion that has a very fascinating multiplicity of meanings. So to speculate, of course, means to do risky, to take wagers in the financial markets, to short, to take great risks, but it also means it has a long history of signifying a certain way of creating a narrative about the future, be that in religion or in the spaces of magic and the occult, or indeed in the space of sciences and philosophy itself. To speculate is an attempt to control, to negotiate the uncertainty of a future and to propose a certain way of giving, ascribing meaning to it. And there was something in that multiple meanings of speculation that I wanted to recover and to suggest that finance itself understands.
Finance itself understands this? Tell us what you mean here.
What I mean by that is that on one level, speculation in finance itself isn't merely an economic act. It is also a relational act, and it is an imaginative act. It is a process which traders enter as a community, as an imagined community. There is always something about the ability to imagine what others might value, what others might understand as a future opportunity, and to act in relation to that. So there is an interesting relational and imaginary dimension of speculation in markets themselves that led me to try and conceptualize a new way of political engagement that is increasingly speculative. And we observe it especially in the aftermath of the great financial crisis of 2008, the political events that were difficult to predict, the dominance of the chaotic politics of regressive nationalism, especially in the US and in the UK, the Brexit, of course, the election of Donald Trump, but also globally, this kind of bizarre mix of nationalism, nativism, the evangelicals in Brazil, let's say, Hindu nationalism in India, and so on. But all these kind of political narratives that seem to be making not so much claims to a future of stability, but as to a way of offering a way through chaos. A narrative that seemed to be appealing to voters in spite of its obvious weakness in delivering any real answers. And there was something there in the politics, in the expression of collective politics that we observe in many of those occasions that I wanted to capture as a form of speculative politics. In other words, as a form of politics that aims to not avoid, control, or manage the uncertainty of political future, but endorses, embraces, perhaps counterintuitively, embraces elements of that uncertainty, and even chooses to cultivate it and immerses itself into these tidal waves of uncertainty. So, you know, a vote for Brexit, perhaps seen not as an investment in a stable future, but as a way of destabilizing the political system, the neoliberal political system, and in doing so, creating a new collective narrative of that future. So, as you will understand, as you will be clearer by the examples I'm offering here, these instantiations of the speculative politics, of the speculative imagination, that we've observed recently have tended to be regressive types, the kinds of movements that speculated in a xenophobic, racist, and nationalist manner. But importantly, in the book, the argument I try to make and suggest is that these are forms of politics that we also observe on the left, and often we neglect, we overlook, precisely because they don't look the way the traditional forms of organized politics looked like. And so this is the kind of more swarm-like politics that works in the space of, say, the ephemeral technologies, the ephemeral spaces offered by mainstream social media, that works with instability, it works with elements of sabotage, of volatility, of cultivating volatility in order to harm political opponents. But importantly, modes of politics that cultivate a certain collective way of acting in that speculative way. And so often the example that people think of when I talk about that is something like the GameStop saga, the mass shorting of these retail traders, in the case of the GameStop company, a stock, this attempt to take revenge against the hedge funders that were shorting that stock, that had this important connotation of a traditional gaming community engagement.
We have to leave it there. Aris Komporosos Athanasiou, you can find the spelling of his name on againstthegrain.org, is a sociologist based at University College London's Social Research Institute. His new book, published by the University of Chicago Press, is Speculative Communities: Living with Uncertainty in a Financialized World. Thank you, Aris, for your work and for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.